Accentuate the positive. Eliminate the negative. Accentuate the positive.
Welcome to Political Rewind. We're playing Georgia's own Johnny Mercer's composition, Accentuate the Positive, because producer Lisa Clark pointed out to us this morning that Governor Deal, when he gives his State of the State address, which he just did about 2 hours ago, always picks a theme, and his theme this year was Johnny Mercer's Accentuate the Positive. Among other things, he said that he is going to focus positively on fixing the state's failing schools. Let's listen just for a moment.
2 years ago, there were 127 chronically failing schools with roughly 68,000 enrolled students. Now that we have the data from the last school year, we find that there were 153 schools that had failing scores for three consecutive years.
All right, that was Governor Nathan Deal just about 2+ hours ago, 3 hours ago now, giving his State of the State address. We're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show, but let's face it, the big news of today really is Donald Trump, President-elect Trump, giving his first news conference in just about 6 months. So joining us today to discuss it, we're really thrilled to welcome Anita Sharp, who is the Bloomberg News Bureau Chief here in Atlanta. It's great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming in, Anita.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to. Julianne Thompson, Republican strategist and a longtime leader in the Georgia Republican Party. We haven't seen you for a while, Julianne. Thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
You just told us you're going to be up at the inauguration and one of the big balls, huh?
I am. I'm going to be at the inauguration and the parade and the opening concert, and I get to go to the inaugural ball.
All right. Well, we're going to expect an on-air report when you come back.
Absolutely.
And Andra Gillespie, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Associate Political Science Professor from Emory University. Thanks for coming in. One of the things about you that we love, Andra, is the way you multitask. I can tell our listeners that even as you're listening to me right now out of one ear, you are plugged into C-SPAN or MSNBC or CNN.
C-SPAN.
Listening to the confirmation hearings for Sessions at this point?
The part that I missed when I was trying to get here.
All right. Let's get right to it. Anita, I don't even know where to begin with this Trump news conference today. It was like everything else we've seen from him throughout the 2 years that he ran his campaign, unorthodox, outrageous, and strangely hypnotic.
Well, just like the campaign, right? It's you know, I was struck by the cheering section and the deflection of so many of the questions. But one refreshing thing about Trump is apparently he did not choose who the questioners were going to be ahead of time, as his predecessors do. So that's kind of refreshing. But that's one of the accentuate the positive.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing that you notice, and people in the media would. We have had such organized news conferences. The presidents of past, certainly the last few presidents, march up there with their cards. You will first call on so-and-so from Bloomberg and then so-and-so from NBC. And it's very regimented and makes it kind of boring, I think, as a result.
Well, this was not boring.
No, it certainly wasn't. Julianne, here's what I thought was fascinating. Before we even get to the Trump sound, let's set this up a bit. One of the things that really, really prepared us for a kind of a crazy news conference was the report overnight that BuzzFeed released from sources that are questionable. They themselves admit their sources were questionable, but they got hold of a report that found its way to American intelligence agencies. We're not sure if it's CIA, FBI, that hasn't been revealed at this point, from an ex-British spy who said in his reporting that Trump and the Russians have been working together for years. They've been prepping him over the years. And that in fact, Trump and Obama had been briefed on this as recently as Friday. It was a startling report, which most major news organizations have condemned because nobody else seems to have gotten to the bottom of this.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, even though there was a definite exchange between Jim Acosta today from CNN and Donald Trump at the news conference regarding that particular piece of news, even CNN has condemned BuzzFeed for running that piece. It's unsubstantiated, and it also contained information that said that Cohen had traveled abroad and met with people from Russia. And then they've come out since and say, oh, it was a different Cohen. It
wasn't the one connected. Yeah, they were talking about first. Talking about a member of the Trump legal team that turned out not to be the same.
It was fake news. It was fake news, completely unsubstantiated. And how do you expect people to take future reports, you know, as news if you poison the news process like that?
So, you know, one thing I will say in defense of journalists like yourself who do this every day, this might be one of those differences between your standard legacy media and new media. So BuzzFeed, this new outlet that has very little staff and where they don't back check stuff and have editors really goes and runs with the story. And then they get caught on the back end because they are putting out rumors that can't be substantiated yet.
Well, just as long as you're talking about the other little piece of inside baseball, and that would be BuzzFeed, in fact, had a team of really strong and highly respected investigative journalists who all flew the coop and went over to CNN to form a new unit. So BuzzFeed is now operating with these newer people with a lot of pressure to produce what their predecessors had done so successfully for them.
Well, and I think that word is very key, pressure, because now it used to be that you could sit on something for a while, certainly overnight in the days of print, and now it's just instant, and everybody is saying if I don't do it, the other guy's going to do it, and that's the excuse. But we are seeing a lot of irresponsible journalism.
All right. So this sets up this morning at Trump Tower, as journalists gathered, it became clear that a lot of questions were going to be asked about this report. There was going to be a lot of controversy in the air about it. Unlike other presidential news conferences, Donald Trump had two people introduce him. And the first one was his new communications director, Sean Spicer, who really set the tone for the kind of peaceful interaction you'd like to see between journalists and the media.
The fact that BuzzFeed and CNN made the decision to run with this unsubstantiated claim is a sad and pathetic attempt to get clicks. The report is not an intelligence report, plain and simple. For all the talk lately about fake news, this political witch hunt by some in the media is based on some of the most flimsy reporting, and it's frankly shameful and disgraceful. With that, it is my honor to introduce the next Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence.
We had to leave the intro. Well, with that, let's get on with the business of the day. But then Vice President Pence came up to introduce Donald Trump. And he, too, went after BuzzFeed and talked about fake news, scurrilous reporting. The worst thing about this, it seems to me, as we now turn to the Trump news conference, Andra, is it's flipped the whole notion of fake news. Fake news was what we called the stories that came out from publications like Breitbart, who were attacking Hillary Clinton and other Democrats with very little basis and making up stories in some cases. The right has done a wonderful job co-opting it and using it as an expression against. Why do you think that's funny?
Oh, my gosh.
But it's true.
True fake news is when the right uses it against the left. They've done a great job of co-opting it now that the shoe is on the other foot. Thank you for that.
Well, okay, so here's what I'll say with that. And I do agree with Julianne. I never really thought that fake news was partisan or that it was biased one way or the other. I've always thought that all sides were capable of producing fake news. My issue with fake news is that when you disseminate information that you know is unsubstantiated, that you know is going to put up a headline that's going to be clickbait, and then says crazy stuff that it's really hard to kind of backtrack and get people to unknow. That's a process of fake news. So I want to look at anybody who's doing that, regardless of their ideology, and then I want to look at the consumer of it to teach them how to be better consumers of data and to know when to be discerning.
She's right, 100%.
Okay, thank you.
I have nothing to add to that.
Okay, I stand corrected. Which is all diverting us from really the story of the hour, which is Trump and the things he said at his news conference. He, too, of course, was asked to weigh in on the BuzzFeed report. And he was asked what he chose to turn that into his feelings right now about U.S. intelligence agencies, because someone in U.S. intelligence did leak the fact that they had briefed President Obama and President-elect Trump on this alleged report about Trump and his engagement with the Russians during their briefings last week. But here's what Trump said.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do. I think it's a disgrace that information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public. As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are.
Anita, the Obama administration has waged quite a war against leakers, of course. It's not as if they haven't been tough on people who join hands with the media. But this proclamation by the president-elect really takes his war with the intelligence agency to a whole new level.
Well, it does. And you think about, why did this get leaked and who did it? And realizing that once Trump does take office, he's in charge of the intelligence agencies, and so it's unlikely that he will order an investigation of this stuff. And so perhaps it was leaked because if not now, then when? Because I think it's also important to point out that these reports are unsubstantiated. They should not have been published. However, I don't think they've been proven to be true or false at this point. So we just don't know.
Julianne, though, what about the way Donald Trump is approaching dealing with CIA, FBI, the whole intelligence apparatus?
They're going to be working for him and for this country, and I think he needs to do a much better job at respecting them. That being said, I, as a citizen, I don't know which I'm more frightened about, the fact that some national security agency like the CIA would base information on an alleged report that contained false information, or the fact that they leaked that report. Both of those things are very scary to me as a citizen, so I understand why he would be upset. Although I don't ever like comparisons to Nazi Germany unless it's valid. I'm sure he was referring to political propaganda being used against someone that they disagree with politically. However, it's just a frightening situation all the way around.
You know what? I think President-elect Trump is going to learn how to work with his intelligence agencies, and he's going to learn how dependent he's going to be on them. I think he's also going to try to figure out that while he does lead this massive bureaucracy of millions of employees, he doesn't have the control over them that he would have had if, you know, you were chairman and CEO of the Trump Organization. So I think, you know, he's going to try to crack down on leaks probably throughout the executive branch. And there's probably going to come a time where he's going to have a really hard time trying to control those leaks going forward. So I think he has to be prepared for the fact that executive branch employees are not just accountable to him. They feel accountable to Congress, and they usually kind of do what they want to do.
It's been suggested that it's not in terms of this specific leak, but a couple other things that have happened, that perhaps the intelligence community is trying to show President Trump that they have an awful lot of information, they have ways to get it out, and they've got some power in this equation, too. That may be a little too Machiavellian. I don't know, Anita.
Well, I think that's a great point. And also, you have to sort of look at where this information originally came from, the anti-Trump forces. I'm kind of reading that as not necessarily the Democratic opposition, but perhaps within his own party. And so you've also going back to the press conference and the questions about Lindsey Graham and sort of the disparaging comments that Trump made about, again, somebody from his own party. So that's going to be also a very interesting thing to follow over the next 4 years, is that he just doesn't have necessarily the backing of the traditional backing that a president comes in with his own party.
I mean, I agree and I disagree. I think he has the backing. I think that Lindsey Graham did a fantastic job in the Sessions confirmation hearings. He's definitely stood behind Sessions, took up for him, really slammed the other side. I think Donald Trump misunderstood what the news reporter was saying to him, that Lindsey Graham was going to be sending him a bill with more sanctions in it, and immediately his tendency to go off the cuff with his comments took over, and he said something that he shouldn't have said.
He said he'll be moving up 1%, something
yeah,
like
right,
that.
Right,
he
right.
just has to go back to the campaign, which he did over and over again in the beginning of this news conference today, Andre. He kept referring back to Hillary Clinton, for instance.
Right. I mean, so even when he halfway acknowledges that Russia did try to hack the United States, this is more of a campaign issue and a chance for him to re-legitimize his win, which at this point, while there are many people who are upset by the fact that he won, I don't think anybody is disputing the fact that he won and that he's going to be president next Friday at noon. And so I think he's going to have to learn to work past that. That's sort of part of being commander in chief. That's part, you know, of him evolving and maturing as a leader. But the other thing that he did that was actually really similar to the campaign is his classic strategy. Anytime somebody critiques him, he inverts the critique and throws it back on them to deflect attention away from the valid points of the critique that was being levied toward him.
He, of course, was asked about ACA, about Obamacare, how quickly it was going to be repealed and replaced. And, of course, we know that's become a significant debate on the Hill, a concern among the Republicans will have to do this. They're committed to repealing as quickly as they can, and they've begun that process today on the Hill through reconciliation. But, of course, the question became how fast will they replace it? And, you know, we know there are some Republican members, both the Freedom Caucus on the kind of far right and a lot of moderate Republicans have said, maybe you better slow this down a little bit here. An interesting coming together of forces. Trump told the New York Times the other day, I want it done quickly. And he repeated that today.
17 is going to be the bad year. It's going to be catastrophic. Frankly, we could sit back. And it was a thought from a political standpoint, but it wouldn't be fair to the people. We could sit back and wait and watch and criticize. And we could be a Chuck Schumer and sit back and criticize it. And the easiest thing would be to let it implode in 17. And believe me, we'd get pretty much whatever we wanted, but it would take a long time. We're going to be submitting as soon as our secretary is approved. Almost simultaneously, shortly thereafter, a plan. It'll be repeal and replace. It will be essentially simultaneously. It will be various segments, you understand, but will most likely be on the same day or the same week, but probably the same day, could be the same hour. So we're going to do repeal and replace, very complicated stuff. And we're going to get a health bill passed. We're going to get health care taken care of in this country. Obamacare is the Democrats' problem. We are going to take the problem off the shelves for them. We're doing them a tremendous service by doing it. We could sit back and let them hang with it.
Well, I let that play out a little bit, Anita, because it just says something about the way in which Trump has always kind of framed his arguments. He goes all over the place on these things. He's doing the Democrats a favor. We're going to make this happen right away. 2017 was going to be the worst year ever, which we don't know at this point, except we think ACA has been doing fairly well this year. What he's asking Congress to do, their rubber's going to meet the road on this thing, isn't it?
Well, that's exactly right. It's puzzling because he said in his remarks, this is very complicated, and yet we're going to do repeal and replace on the same day, maybe the same hour. And my question is, how is that going to happen? You know, one thing, too, that's intriguing to me, apparently there's in the fine print of Paul Ryan's plan is to pay for a new program by taxing employer-provided health care. So that would be a tax hit to the majority of Americans. Has it been publicized a lot? Who knows if it'll happen? But, you know, there are a lot of things that are just sort of head-scratchers here.
Okay. Julianne.
Yes.
Do you think there are Trump voters out there who are beginning to look at ACA and wonder if, in fact, maybe they shouldn't have been so enthusiastic about the notion of it being repealed?
Really? You're asking
yeah.
someone who started with a $500 a month family policy, and my policy went up to $1,300 per month for my family in just in a matter of a year. And then this past year, Aetna left Georgia, so we had to sign up for something new at an astronomical rate that we can't afford. No. I mean, that is one of the key components as to why Donald Trump was successful in his election is because of the repeal and replacement talking points regarding the contradiction in terms that is the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about that is that there are people in your position who are better off than others, and then there are those who would qualify for subsidies under Obamacare who are now entering into uncertain territory where they're not quite sure what they're going to be able to get and what they're going to be able to afford if it's replaced. One of the interesting things about the Trump coalition is that from a traditional ideological standpoint, it wasn't what we would call ideologically kind of coherent. And so the bundles of issues that people would put together that we would think of as being traditionally conservative weren't necessarily all the same bundles of issues that were motivating Trump voters. And I think that's where where the challenge kind of lies there is that there are people like you who we would argue are going to be kind of very consistent conservatives, you know, who understand what they think and use that framework to kind of inform what they think about lots of issues. But there are other people who put different bundles together. And so, you know, the classic one that I think about is a picture that I saw of somebody at a Tea Party rally who was like, but save my Medicare. And thinking about how those go together, I think as somebody who studies this, we have to think very differently about ideology and think that the things that we think sort together don't always sort together in the minds of a lot of voters.
And I have a question. I'm not an expert on this, but you talked about the process starting today with reconciliation.
Yeah.
And it's my understanding that a lot of key components of the Affordable Care Act cannot be removed through reconciliation.
They can unwind some of it through reconciliation, enough of it that it will put them in a position where they can replace the rest. And I'm not quite sure what they do about the remnants that reconciliation doesn't take care of. Anybody? It's a complicated and complex process, but it's a good point.
But is it one of those components, the pre-existing conditions, which is huge?
Trump has said we want to keep pre-existing conditions and allowing your children to age 26 stay on your policy. Look, we've got a lot to get to, but I do want to get to one final Trump bite that was really telling today. Because, of course, he was asked about his relationship with Vladimir Putin over and over. Let's just listen to one of the things he said.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, I consider that an asset, not a liability. Because we have a horrible relationship with Russia. Russia can help us fight ISIS, which, by the way, is number one tricky. I mean, if you look, this administration created ISIS by leaving at the wrong time. The void was created. ISIS was formed. If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now,
so meanwhile, Andre Gillespie, his nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is on the Hill this morning being grilled by people like Senator Marco Rubio about whether or not Russians are war criminals, whether he will be tough on the Russians. And Tillerson is essentially, well, he won't say anything about war criminals. Mm-hmm. But he has said, yes, Russia was wrong in Crimea. They were wrong in eastern Ukraine. We are going to be aggressive against them.
I'll give President-elect Trump credit for one thing. ISIS was created in a power vacuum. So with that being said, President Trump also has to steer clear of the fact that he does have Russia hawks who he's nominated for positions, and that there's probably going to be some conflict with respect to that. The other thing that kind of strikes me about his pronouncements about Vladimir Putin is whether or not he's cognizant of or respects the institutional memory of people like President Obama or President Bush before them, people who tried to have some type of rapprochement with Russia and it didn't work out. And so he seems to think that this is a personal type of relationship where this might not be, and it might be a strategic relationship. And if a Democratic and a Republican predecessor both ended up feeling betrayed by Vladimir Putin, that does not bode well for him being able to forge, you know, the type of strong, positive relationship that he hopes to get.
Well, Putin. It was telling, I thought, this morning that when Tillerson was asked what he would have done about the Russian incursion into Crimea in eastern Ukraine, and Tillerson said essentially he would have encouraged the Ukrainians to mount their defensive forces on the border of Crimea. He would have provided U.S. intelligence source to help them deal with it. He would have put planes in the air overhead to monitor. He struck a much more aggressive tone than anything we've heard from Donald Trump.
Well, that was surprising, and you have to ask the question: was that strategically, part of his game plan to make sure that the confirmation goes smoothly? I would say, what else could he say? He could not really go the other way.
Well, he actually. That was incorrect. He might have not, I mean, not what you said, but what Bill had said earlier about not referring to them as war criminals. He did come out and he did say, yes, these are war crimes. And I think that he summed everything up. I think he summed everything up as to the way that he feels, and I'm sure the way the president-elect feels with this statement. As with China, sometimes Russia will be a partner and sometimes an adversary, but engagement is necessary in order to keep things from spiraling out of control.
He actually, in being questioned about that by Rubio and then by Menendez, was asked whether Putin was a war criminal. He said, I don't have enough information. But then when the chair said, what if you had the information that said he was a war criminal, would you accept that he is one? He said, yes, I would. Just to clarify how that developed. And, you know, that's a positive sign, but I think that's how it came down as I listened to it unfold.
Well, they did specify some of the things that Putin had done, and he said, do you consider those to be war crimes? He said, yes.
Fair enough. Yeah, look, the point I was trying to make is Tillerson was tough on Russia today, which surprised many of us.
Right.
Look, we got to take a break. Lisa Raham from Lawmakers is standing by, because when we come back from the break, we're going to talk a little bit about the governor's State of the State address, and then we're going to turn to Jeff Sessions confirmation hearings, which have really been interesting. It's 2:33. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, when kids would say, Mr. Buck, how do I get into broadcasting? Start smoking. Joe Buck didn't follow this advice his dad, Hall of Fame announcer Jack Buck, gave to other kids, but Joe did go on to become an Emmy Award-winning sportscaster himself. He has a new memoir. We'll talk about his good luck, his childhood, and why he thinks some fans can't stand him. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're talking about so much news breaking all over Washington, Georgia, and other parts of the country today. Andre Gillespie from Emory University is with us. Julianne Thompson, who's a Republican strategist and a longtime leader in the Georgia Republican Party. Anita Sharp, who's the bureau chief for Bloomberg News here in Atlanta, also with us. And we're now joined by Lisa Raham, who is the correspondent for Lawmakers, the GPB TV show that's on the air every night at 7 o'clock. Lisa, you were there for the governor's State of the State address today?
I was, and the theme of that address was accentuate the positive.
Yeah.
And, I think it worked, because after the address was about 40 minutes long, and afterwards, polling some of the lawmakers, everybody seemed to be on one accord. You couldn't find very many who didn't like what Governor Deal had to say today.
So it looked like to us, that from watching the feedback here, that education really was what he was most concerned about. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, leading into the session, I think we all felt that education would dominate this term, and it's probably likely going to be the dominating factor this go-round. A lot of people concerned about those failing schools. Governor Deal announced that last year we thought there was only 123, but after more looking into that issue, they found that at least 153 schools are reeling in bad health. So the concern really needs to be there. The focus really needs to be there. But the question is how we're going to mend these schools. So that seems to still be up in the air because he was very vague about that.
You know, it's interesting. I think I'm right. He did not mention, or at least only vaguely referred to the fact that the way he had hoped to heal those schools was through the Opportunity School Districts, which failed at the ballot last fall. He said almost nothing about the failure of that.
Yeah, he skated right over that. And I think that goes in line with him trying to keep the tone very, very positive, as David Ralston went into the term saying he wanted as well.
All right, let's listen to what the governor said about his challenge on that.
For those who will contend that the real issue is lack of resources, let me remind them I've increased K through 12 spending by $2,017,000,000 over the last 4 years, which includes, of course, this year's fiscal year 18 proposal. That translates into roughly 50% of all new growth in state revenue being dedicated to K through 12 public education.
Which, by the way, is as good a time as any to point out that he is right after the State of the State, reporters were invited into a session, a budget briefing, where they unveiled the biggest budget in the history of the state, some $24 billion. Lisa, the other things that people have been focusing on is health care and how we're going to close this like $600 million hole in the state's health care budget. He's proposing a hospital bed tax. That's going to be controversial throughout the session.
Yeah, well, as you know, anytime you bring up the word tax, it seems to be controversial from the start. So, he talked about that. And he also talked about just kind of laying low and trying to see what the federal government is going to do about health care in general. So I think he's really waiting and watching Washington to see what their actions will do and how they will filter down to the state of Georgia.
Anybody else want to weigh in on what any of their thoughts about this? How is a bed tax going to play with your friends, Julianne?
It never plays out well. but I think that she is 100% correct that he is going to lay low, that the whole legislature is going to lay low for the next few weeks and see what happens in Washington. I think that's been the talk all along.
Yeah, but Anita, this again points to the concerns that people are raising about what is going to happen with the Trump administration. There are so few details. And even the new Republican Congress suddenly handed full control. They have to come up with some substantive answers to problems so states can deal with issues like this.
Right. And right now, it's all rhetoric. And I mean, we just don't know. We can it's anybody's guess. But one thing I just wanted to bring up, going back to the Governor Deal's speech today, is there was little or no discussion about religious liberty and some of those hot buttons that the legislature has been sort of, I think, committed to readdressing in this session.
I don't know if they're committed or not, because leading into the session, House Speaker David Ralston said he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. You poll some of the other lawmakers, they have no interest in that. Again, waiting to see what Washington will do, or if it needs to be across the board something dictated from Washington, because no, they don't want to put their hands on it because it is so controversial. So I don't think we're going to see it come up this go-round. Oh.
Well, Josh McCoon, Andre, certainly says
he's
going
to. I was going to ask about that. Oh, yeah. I think he'll raise his hands a few times, but he doesn't have the support that he may think he have this go around.
And there already is a federal RFRA law that was signed into law by Bill Clinton in the 90s.
Well,
so it already exists.
You know, I think it's fair to say that somebody like a Josh McCoon, whether he can pass it or not, knows that he's got a political future he'd like to look to, and he's got a certain constituency
right.
that is to who is going. They're going to be grateful if he keeps pushing at this. Lisa, anything else we should mention?
A big deal was made about cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And I think the timing is so appropriate with what's going on in Washington again with, the Russians and all of that. So he made a big deal about that. And everybody seemed very, very pleased. They thought it was timely. They thought it was needed. And they didn't mind seeing dollars being allocated for it.
And I understand that Georgia is sort of ground central in Augusta for the nation's cybersecurity efforts. So this could be a big deal in terms of job creation and all kinds of things.
Oh, for sure, for the state of Georgia, for sure.
All right, Lisa Raham, we're going to, I guess, the entire State of the State address
tonight
will air tonight at 7 p.m. on GPT. Georgia Public Television.
There you go.
I'm sorry. It's been a long day.
Yeah, I'm so sure. And then afterwards, we'll be around to chat a little bit about it.
You'll be there. So. Greg Bluestein from the AJC will be there. Lisa, will you come visit us throughout the session?
I would love to.
It's really great
Thanks
to have you on board.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For being here.
Glad
Tell
to be
you
here.
What, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's talk about Jeff Sessions and a few other items that involve Georgians in the news. This is Political Rewind at 2:41.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal. Resolved to lose a few pounds this year? How about a few thousand? Donate your old car, truck, or RV. Drop a lot of unwanted weight from your garage and support public radio.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
Break it down.
Listen you up. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Anita Sharp from Bloomberg, Julianne Thompson from Georgia, and Andra Gillespie from Emory University are with us. Andra, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General nominee, now in his second day of hearings on the Hill. I didn't know what adjective. I wanted to say contentious. I'm not sure he's gotten as rough a ride as some people thought he might. On the other hand, there have been questions raised about his commitment to civil rights.
Well, at the end of the day, it seems like he's probably going to have the votes that he'll need for confirmation. So I think most people who came out to oppose him did so on principle. I think they knew that the likelihood that they were going to be able to persuade enough Republicans to defect was going to be small. I think it's the nature of the opposition that I think is really notable. So it's not just you expect the NAACP, you expect women's groups to come out, you expect pro-LGBT groups to be able to come out. Having, the trifecta of Cedric Richmond, John Lewis, and Cory Booker come out against him today, particularly Booker, a sitting senator, against another sitting senator, I think, really kind of speaks to the sense of threat that people in minority communities feel. And the reason why I think they felt compelled to do this was it's their job, as they view it, to give voice to these kinds of issues. I mean, I've known Booker for 15 years, wrote a book about him. He wouldn't do this lightly. And so I think he, as the highest ranking Black Democrat in the Senate, felt that he had to give voice to this to try to persuade his his colleagues to think differently about this
We
issue.
Should put just a couple of the issues. Some of them have to do with his direct stance on some civil rights issues when he was in Alabama. But even in the U.S. Senate, voted against reauthorization of the Violence Against Women's Act. He voted against the Matthew Shepard, James Byrd Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which certainly spoke to African-American and gay communities around the country. Those are the kinds of issues, Julianne, which really have caused people to wonder about his commitment to equality, equal justice under the law.
Okay, you're going to have to give me a couple minutes to answer that. First of all,
she's got her notes out.
Of course I do. Of course I do, because I think that if there is one thing that America has grown sick and tired of, it's race baiting. And with regard to Senator Booker, Senator Sessions and Senator Booker co-sponsored a bill to award the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor to the Selma marchers. I have on my phone right here a soundbite of Senator Booker praising Senator Sessions. But it was convenient that he today could use the floor of the Judiciary Committee to kick off his 2020 presidential exploratory campaign. With regard to the Violence Against Women Act, what he opposed was not the overall bill, But he felt strongly, and he said this, felt very strongly, that allowing tribal courts to try non-tribal citizens violated the Constitution and was a poison pill in the reauthorization legislation. That is why he opposed that. With regard to the Shepherd Byrd Hate Crimes Act, he was very, very specific as to what he said there. He was accused of saying that there was no problem when it came to LGBT members of society being attacked. That is not what he said. What he said was taken completely out of context. What he actually said was that he did not see a problem in the state's prosecution of these crimes, pointing to the fact, specifically in the Shepherd and Byrd cases, that the two of the perpetrators received the death penalty. The other two received back-to-back life sentences. You don't get any stronger in prosecution and sentencing than the death penalty and life sentences.
All right. So you got to want to say anything?
Well, I mean, you know, I understand all of those points. And I think the fact that Sessions has actually tried to construct a response and a rebuttal to that in anticipation of that is evidence of the fact that he knew that this was potentially a weak spot for him. I think that's why, you know, he was able to enlist a number of supporters, including African-Americans, in an attempt to rebut what he was going to perceive to be an attack by the civil rights community. I think that there are, you know, a couple of things. I think the civil rights community would look, one, I think at, you know, honoring the Selma marchers on the 50th anniversary as something that was purely symbolic. And I know he did work as, you know, an assistant U.S. attorney and prosecuting civil rights cases that kind of came before his court. But people have not looked at Jeff Sessions as being on the forefront of civil rights issues. So, I mean, if he had had the profile of somebody like a Morris Deese, for instance, then I don't think we would be having this type of conversation. But Sessions didn't come from that particular perspective. And I understand the debate about whether or not the notion of a hate crime should exist and whether or not there should be deeper penalties. But I think you just have to concede that other people who are supportive of adding extra penalties for hate crimes because of the heinous of the animus that's, you know, directing sort of these attacks against these vulnerable people is something that's going to sort of set people off and is actually going to be grounds for opposing them.
But can I say this? Let me go a step further.
Real quick.
Talking about Alabama and his history. He prosecuted Henry Francis Hayes, the son of an Alabama Klan leader, Benny Hayes, for killing a black teen named Michael Donald. He made sure that he was executed when he became attorney general. That caused a $7 million civic judgment against the Klan, and he broke the back of the Klan in Alabama. This is Jeff Sessions' history. This is his past.
I think here is where the difference lies. We still have a debate in this country about race, what constitutes racism. I think the obvious stuff, I think we're all kind of in agreement about. It's the structural stuff and the not so obvious stuff that I think we're having contentious debates about. We had it in the election, and I think we're having it now right here.
Anita, it's interesting to listen to this. Mm-hmm. But what really happens in these things is it's the perception of the public. It's the American people. They may or may not get into the details that a Julianne is talking about. They may not understand how we view race differently. And in that context, the question becomes how important is the testimony of our own John Lewis, who was on who sat before the committee just before we came on the air.
There are forces that want to take us back to another place. We don't want to go back. We want to go forward. It doesn't matter how Senator Sessions may smile, how friendly he may be, how he may speak to you. But we need someone who's going to stand up, speak up, and speak out for the people that need help, for people being discriminated against. And it doesn't matter whether they're black or white, Latino, Asian American, or Native American, whether they're straight or gay, Muslim, Christian, or Jews, we all live in the same house, the American house. We need someone as Attorney General who's going to look out for all of us, and not just for some of us.
Never once said that Jeff Sessions wasn't capable of that, never condemned him in any way. He just said this is what we should expect from an attorney general.
Well, and John Lewis is an icon, and everything he said is very consistent with who he is and who he has been from, you know, the days of the civil rights movement. As Andrea said, I mean, there's no question or very little question that Sessions, you know, he will get confirmed. So making these statements, though, is important in terms of speaking to his own constituency and also just making the point to people who may not be necessarily hearing that on a day-to-day basis. And I also, just one other point I wanted to make about this, I think a lot of this really goes to the culture wars, which are at the root of kind of where we are today, that people aren't drilling down to the fine points. They're just listening to the top notes. We are a soundbite top note society now.
Right. And I think one of the other things to kind of keep in mind, it's not just what Congressman Lewis said, but it was also Congressman Richmond, the chairman of the CBC, and I think Cornell Brooks in the earlier session this morning. I think for a lot of African Americans in particular, a lot of this has to do with voting rights. And Richard Shelby has said some interesting things in the last few years that run counter to what many perceive to be the interests of African Americans with respect to the Voting Rights Act in terms of how he perceives voter fraud in the United States. So, you know, I know, Julianne, you and I disagree about this, but we don't find a lot of empirical evidence to say that there was voter fraud, yet Senator Sessions thinks that it is. And so he's interested in doing things like voter ID laws, which we're still studying. There's a lot of mixed evidence. But, you know, even if we take the evidence as mixed, there's a question historically, and this is why Congressman Richmond's comments were actually really important today, about looking at the way laws have been created that were intended, even if they didn't in fact have the impact of attempting to disenfranchise minority groups. And that's what people feel threatened by. And so Senator Sessions, on that regard, even if he could prosecute the Klan in Alabama, even if he could execute people who killed black people for no reason, those are the kinds of things that are actually bread and butter and that hit lots of people, not just those who unfortunately kind of, you know, cross paths with a racist who wants to kill somebody one day.
I think it's a huge, huge and very irresponsible stretch for someone to assume or insinuate that anyone has any sort of racist tendencies because they believe they should show ID before they vote in something as serious as an election in the United States. And I think that if you polled the vast majority of the country, you would find that the vast majority of people agree with me.
Right. But I think this is where sort of understanding sort of like the historical context in which people register concerns, I think, is actually really important. It's not that people are pulling this out of thin air. We've had people use creative, facially non-racial ways to try to deny people the vote. And so when people see voter ID laws, or when you see legislators, say in Pennsylvania, who acknowledge that they're trying to depress Democratic votes by instituting voter ID laws, it's really hard to disentangle that. And that doesn't mean that the individual supporters or even some of the individual legislators necessarily have a racial intent. But if somebody points out that this might actually disproportionately affect certain groups, then I think what people want is a recognition of that and perhaps a reconsideration of that before one moves
so
forward.
So I'm going to jump in because I was interested in Julianne, what you had to say about to make the leap that saying someone's a racist, that was a wake-up call for me in a way, because I heard you. And what I think, when I hear the two of you go back and forth, what I think about is, when you think about, and I know you've got your notes, but the Violence Against Women's Act, the Matthew Shepard, James mm-hmm. Byrd, Hate Crimes Act, all this sort of stuff, and some of his civil rights stand, it does seem to me that you have a right to bristle if we characterize someone as a racist because of those things. I really do think you may have a point there. That isn't the same, though, I think, as saying that you worry that they're not a promoter of equal justice for all.
Or that when confronted with discordant information, that people aren't considering and updating, at least explaining what's going on. And so if people don't think that they are being heard as they're registering these concerns, then that's the kind of thing that's going to engender opposition.
Anita, this really does tell us that we're in for a difficult debate in this country, I think, in the years ahead. And it would have been the same debate if Hillary Clinton had been president Donald Trump.
Of course. I mean, it seems like almost everything that happens, whether it be today's news conference, makes the divide deeper. And I think President Obama last night, we haven't talked about that, but I think that, you know, he has tried to pull the country together, didn't succeed in a way that a lot of people would have liked to have seen. But I think people are looking to Donald Trump for that kind of for him to do something along those lines to pull us together.
Well, with that in mind, President Obama gave his farewell address last night in Chicago at McCormick Place. We're going to play just a little of what he said.
After my election, there was talk of a post-racial America. And such a vision, however well-intended, was never realistic. Race remains a potent and often divisive force in our society. And all of us have more work to do. If every economic issue is framed as a struggle between a hardworking white middle class and an undeserving minority, then workers of all shades are going to be left fighting for scraps while the wealthy withdraw further into their private enclaves.
That's just a little bit of what President Obama had to say last night. I did think some of his prescriptions, Andres, sounded a little bit too poetical, and whether, you know, we need to reach out to one another and things that are not going to happen.
Well, you know, they're not going to happen for some people, a lot of people, but yeah, they could happen for some people.
Okay.
And I think there are some important things to think about, like getting out of your avatar and actually talking to real people.
Yeah.
People just need to do that. I have to admit, on the last day of my class last semester, with my students who were from the coast who were shocked at the outcome of the election, I was like, why don't you go meet somebody who's different? I was like, why don't you go to the middle part of the country and not just to go ski, but to do other kinds of things? So I think that while many people won't heed it, and while those individual types of interactions aren't going to deal with the entirety of the issues that affect us, it's a step, and it's a step that individuals can make. And so that's what I think you're trying to do.
We're out of time. We've just run completely out of time. I'd like another hour today to have all of you share more of your thoughts on all the news breaking today. But Anita Sharp, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Julianne Thompson, always good to see you. Andre Gillespie as well. We have to take a moment to say goodbye to, I think, the best intern, Jenny Ament, wouldn't you say, we've had ever. Robert Jimison leaves us today. He is going off to CNN's health unit, where you may see him as an intern actually on television talking about health issues. And he's a pretty good-looking guy, so you're going to want to be able to see him. Robert, you have been just a joy to have with us, and thank you for all you've done, and we hope we can have you come back and visit us often. Jenny, Ament, terrific job. Lisa Clark, a lot of pressure today, but you pulled through. And Stephen Fowler is in the control room, too. He's going to be helping run our board in the weeks ahead. So thanks to all of you who helped put this show together. We're back with you, of course, on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. We are not going to be here on Monday. Well, we are going to be here. It's the King holiday. But we're going to play a special interview, a conversation I had with Andy Young in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library, in which he talked about his life and career and certainly talked about his work with Dr. King. We're going to have that on the air special for you next Monday for the King holiday, and then we're back again next Wednesday with another live show at 2. So that's it for us for today. Back Friday with Jim Galloway and Greg Bluestein talking about the news of the week. I'm Bill Nygut. See you then. We'll be right back.